Even Britain, as it happens, has avoided the reckless deindustrialization allowed in the United States. Although British manufacturing exports lack the comparative heft they registered in 1870 or 1900, economic historians underscore that in 1990, merchandise exports represented 21% of British GDP, whereas in the United States they amounted to only 8%. Between 2000 and 2003, the share of U.S. GDP represented by manufactured exports dropped from 7% to 6%, and it is chilling to contemplate what the ratios might be in 2010 or 2020. Chapter 10 will focus more on China and East Asia, but for the moment, let us simply say that overall Chinese manufacturing and export levels may well vie with those of the United States by the 2020s. Moreover, China is already responsible for the bulk of the rapidly growing U.S. deficit, $37 billion in 2004, in what Washington calls ATP, Advanced Technology Products. Here we are talking about major categories such as biotechnology, weapons, optoelectronics, and nuclear technology, not mere circuit boards or routine components. Clyde Prestowitz, the longtime president of the Washington-based Economic Strategy Institute, all but tolled the bell for U.S. manufacturing only a few years into the new century. The supposed 2003 to 2004 comeback of the U.S. technology sector after the NASDAQ stock collapse fell short across a range that included semiconductor production, laptops, and high-definition television. Serious renewal in the Midwestern Rust Belt, meanwhile, was belied by the early 2000s disasters in the steel and automobile industries. In 3 billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East, Prestowitz profiled a trio of critical weaknesses in America's dying tech ecosystem. 1. Research and development. 2. Present and future workforce education. And 3. The particular peril posed to high technology leadership by the nation's increasing inability to implement, test, or support that expertise in an actual manufacturing milieu. This seems to be a pervasive concern among both academic experts and captains of industry. The actual making of advanced technologies in the United States had slipped far enough that in 2003, Thomas S. Hartwick, former scientist at TRW and chairman of the Department of Defense's Advisory Group on Electronic Devices, told Congress that the structure of the U.S. high-tech industry is coming unglued, with innovation and design losing their tie to prototype fabrication and manufacturing. These losses leave inventions on the cutting floor because they cannot be manufactured. The Department of Defense was particularly nervous because the advanced semiconductor production needed for a new generation of weapons was migrating to Asia. Randall Isaac, former vice president for strategic alliances at IBM Technology, said, "You can't do effective R&D if you don't have the manufacturing to ensure that the R&D is actually relevant. If the United States loses its manufacturing lead, it will lose everything else with it." Governments elsewhere in the world try to maintain a wise balance, but not Washington. Even the military side of the economy gives rise to what humorists like to call déjà vu all over again. Those familiar with British historian Corelli Barnett's searing indictment of British unpreparedness for World War I, his catalog of lackadaisical approaches and naivete in everything from chemicals, coal tars, and munitions to ball bearings, and of Whitehall's lack of attention to how many essential processes, metals, and machine tools were in German or other foreign hands, must cringe at the latter-day U.S. parallels. 4 indicators compiled by Prestowitz make the point. The U.S. need to use Russian, Chinese, and European rockets to launch its space satellites. Boeing's decision to outsource production of the wings on its 787 Dreamliner. The lack of U.S. firms that have the capacity to manufacture the advanced systems for military night vision capacity. French licensees have sold equipment to China. And the U.S. dependence on China for a large number of strategic metals, including tungsten, yttrium, magnesium, antimony, and indium. Such evidence may carry more weight than laments about lost manufacturing and industry. Too many Americans wrongly view these sectors through a rusty rearview mirror, calling to mind the 175-year-old red brick monuments to textile production still visible in New England, the derelict steel mills of Indiana and Pennsylvania, or the sections of Cleveland's Cuyahoga River that used to catch fire because of the flammable debris that accumulated in it. But the industrial age is still with us. China has many tens of millions of automobiles to produce in order to justify those extraordinary Shanghai highways, and India has yet to even construct the roads. The financial media in Delhi and Mumbai underscore the need and prospects for local steel production by reminding readers that the Chinese economy is already nearly 10 times as steel-intensive as India's. Post-industrialism may be imminent in 6 or 8 square miles of information technology-driven Bangalore, but even modern manufacturing is rare across most of the nation, where the population will soon exceed China's. Part of the problem in recognizing the true industrial shape of the world today, of course, lies in post-industrial theory and the proverbial dead economists to whom many Washington conservatives somehow allowed their thought processes to become enslaved. We now turn to them.